Well, good morning. Let's get out our Bibles and turn to the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 26, where we've been for the last several weeks. In this Easter series, a series leading up to Easter, and we're looking at the last 24 hours of Christ's life. And so today we are going to look at one of the trials that he's going to experience, and it's called the Jesus Christ trial. That's the study of, or the title of the study. The Jesus Christ trial. Matthew 26. We'll be looking at verses 57 through 66 in our time together. This is, of course, one of the biggest farces as far as a trial goes, as we look at this trial, as Jesus begins a series, really, of trials that are a miscarriage of justice to the ultimate degree. You talk about being treated unfair. Nobody was treated as unfairly or unjustly as Christ, as we will see. And we're going to learn how to handle unfair treatment as we see him do so. It's not easy to experience being treated wrongly, is it? Unfairly treated is something that even as kids, you know, when you're kids, you tell one of them to do one thing, you tell another of them to do another thing. And have you ever had them say, "Mom, that's not fair"? You ever had that? And you go, "Don't worry about fair, right? Just do what I told you." You ever said that? No? Okay. Pray for me. No, my kids are almost all grown, so we're fine. But, I mean, to be falsely accused is painful. People passing around things that are not true about you, not easy. People lying about you. And it often leads to, hey, with a boss maybe, that's not fair. It's not fair. Why do they get off and I don't get off on that day? Why do they, who have only been around, you know, a short time, get promoted and I still in the same position? It's not fair. You see, when life isn't fair, you have to ask yourself, how do I respond? I'm not sure I'd recommend this, but I was thinking of a story, I read a story rather, of a man who was pulled over for speeding. And a policeman went up to the window and asked for a driver's license, as they do in registration. Well, this man had had several tickets previously and was about to lose his license. And he says, "Sir, officer, please, just give me a warning. Don't give me another ticket. I'm going to lose my license." The officer didn't listen to the pleadings and said, "Listen, license and registration." Well, the man then changes character and he says, "Well, listen, sir, my license has been revoked. And because of my horrible driving record, you see, I don't have a registration because this car is stolen." Or wait a minute, he corrected himself. I think I saw the registration, now that I think about it, in the glove compartment where I put my gun. The officer said, "You have a gun?" The man calmly replied, Oh yeah, I used it to rob the bank just about an hour ago down the street after I threw the money in the truck. I threw the gun in the glove box." Well, the police officer freaked out immediately, pulled out his gun and radioed for backup. And within 2 minutes, several squad cars pulled up, one with the captain in it. And so the captain jumped out of his car and says, "Hey, I'll take care of it from here." And so he approached the car, gun drawn on the driver, asked for identification, and the man pulled out a valid driver's license from his wallet. The captain then asked if the car was stolen, and the man said no. He reached into the glove box where the there were only some napkins in the registration, and he gave it to the captain. And then the confused captain had the man slowly open the trunk, and instead of finding any kind of money there, there was nothing but a spare tire. So the captain, a little confused, he lowers his gun and he says, "I don't understand. The officer that pulled you over and called for backup said you didn't have a driver's license, the car was stolen, you had money in the trunk, and you robbed a bank with a gun that was in the glove compartment." The driver said, "Yeah, and I'll bet you he told you I was speeding too." Guy's got some problems. Let's face it, there are times where life isn't fair. And today we're going to look at the most unfair event in human history. And that's when God himself was put on trial. No one has ever been given less fairness and more injustice than Jesus Christ. However, few people truly realize just how unfair life was for God's own Son. You know, you study this and look at this a trial and how this justice was carried out. It's pretty radical. You know, you tend to say, well, he's in the Garden of Gethsemane, boom, flash, next thing you know, he's on the cross, or he's carrying the cross. But I want us to look at what led to him carrying that cross, so that we can get, as we look at this last 24 hours of his life, the full impact of how he got there, the process that took place. Because I believe as we look at the trial of Jesus, we will see that it represents the darkest day in the history of properly meting out justice. I mean, this man was tried, convicted, and sentenced to death. And yet he was the only perfect man, completely innocent person who had ever lived. Declared guilty of crimes never committed, that he never committed. Sentenced to the most painful form of capital punishment, crucifixion, that was ever devised by man. He was taken first before Annas. The former high priest, around 2 o'clock a.m., that should tell you something there. Then he was taken before Caiaphas, the high priest, excuse me, the head of the Sanhedrin, around 3 o'clock. He was then brought before the entire Sanhedrin around sunup. You see, that right there tells you that something is seriously the matter here. The Sanhedrin that he was brought before eventually was the highest court in all the land. It functioned in just like our Supreme Court does. And listen, only the most serious crimes were brought before this court, before these men. Only the most dangerous criminals were able to get this kind of a hearing. And what I want us to do in our time together is take a look at the legal proceedings of that day step by step. And as we unpack this text and look at this trial, I want you to see for yourselves how unfair, unjust this trial was. Now, just kind of set the background, keep in mind that the job of the Sanhedrin as those who were judging any case was to warn those who were bringing the case, the witnesses, the testimony, the accusations against the defendant. They were warned, listen, life is precious. You better make sure that what you're saying is not false witness. That was their first priority there. They were warned so that they might carefully reflect on whether they had overlooked some circumstance which might play into the favor of this man or the accused being innocent. In other words, the high priest was to advocate and be an advocate for the defendant, innocent till proven beyond the shadow of a doubt, guilty. Now, before we begin with Caiaphas and the entire Sanhedrin, John 18 gives us some insight. And it says that Jesus was first taken to Annas, who was the former high priest and the father-in-law of Caiaphas. You got the connection? There's Annas, who hears the case. He used to be the high priest. And then he is taken before the current high priest, whom Annas is related to. And as we approach this, we're immediately made aware that something isn't right, because it was never proper procedure for anyone to interrogate a defendant alone without other judges being present in that day. Annas, however, heard the accusations. Annas tried Jesus before Caiaphas was involved, along with the entire Sanhedrin. He couldn't get anywhere, couldn't make any sense of the accusations. So he sends him to Caiaphas, and that's where we pick up the story here in Matthew 26. Again, we're going to take every event here in order, and you're going to see why every step of the way there would be no justice for Jesus on this day. In verse 57, it says, "Then the people who had arrested Jesus," that's where we left last time, "led him to the home of Caiaphas, the high priest, where the teachers of the religious law and the elders had gathered." First of all, it's interesting that everyone seemed to be awake and alert at 3 o'clock in the morning. I don't know, that kind of jumps off the page, as I've already stated. Why were they all gathered together at that time of the day? I mean, what's the chances today that the Supreme Court justices would all be awake at 3 o'clock in the morning waiting for a trial? It seems a little suspicious that it's nothing more than a prearranged plot because of their hatred for Jesus. So Luke tells us specifically that he was brought into Caiaphas's house on top of that. Now the problem is, it was illegal for the Sanhedrin to meet anyone except their own, in their own meeting hall that was designed for them, known as the Hall of Judgment. So what are they doing meeting at 3 a.m. in the house of one of the justices privately, and not in the Hall of Judgment, which is where these things were appointed to take place? I mean, it'd be like the Supreme Court meeting at Five Guys or Panera Bread to try something. I mean, that's ridiculous. Add to that that the Sanhedrin's own rules stated that any trial had to be conducted in public, in the open, so that anyone could attend. The reason for this is that there might be some witnesses who could come forward and give testimony to help determine the integrity, the truthfulness of the case. Also, in capital cases, trials had to occur during the daytime, and the verdict had to be reached during the daytime, and it had to take place in at least over 2 days. That's the shortest. And since the Jewish day started at sundown, Jesus was tried, convicted, sentenced, and put to death all in one day. That was completely according to the history, a travesty of justice. Totally illegal. I'm just getting started. Hang on to your hat. I mean, it's going to get worse. It's going to be a bumpy road here. Verse 59 says, "Now the chief priests and the elders and all the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death." And what's wrong with this picture? Well, you got judges, not witnesses, not accusers. You got judges who were there to be neutral parties trying to be the prosecuting attorneys. And to add to that, these judges are seeking what kind of witnesses? False witnesses. They have yet to come. They've arrested him, okay? They brought him before. He's in trial. The judges of Sanhedrin assembled, and they don't even have charges. How many of you have been arrested without charges? I mean, they can't put you in jail without charges. They can't restrain you. They got up charges. They hadn't come up with anything. Any trial is to be clearly stated what the crime is and the alleged defendant, what he has committed, and then independent witnesses are to be produced to support that charge and to testify against that person. And to ensure the fairness, the court could only try cases where an outside party had brought charges. And since charges were being brought against the accused by the court themselves, guess what? The court then was disqualified from trying this case. Getting the picture here? Pretty obvious. They were supposed to be judging the case, not trying the case. These leaders of the Sanhedrin, these judges. Verse 60. It gives us a little more insight. They did not find any, no witnesses that were credible. It says, though many false witnesses came forward. You know what that tells me? They're calling these people in to bring testimony, and they're just looking for anybody. And then when they bring testimony, it's all lies. It's all false. Nobody brings a testimony that's credible in any capacity. You see, according to the law, witnesses were to be sequestered. The practice of, you've heard of sequestration. I mean, the practice of separating witnesses involved in high profile, like the O.J. Court case, that's important, you see, because that is used today because they don't want them to gang up and come to a conclusion and conspire to tell a lie before the trial is, you know, all heard, before all the evidence is on the table. Witnesses are not allowed to hear each other testify because their testimony might be influenced by someone else's testimony. Thus, the story continues. They found none, even though many false witnesses came forward. In verse 60, it says, "And this fellow said, 'I am able to destroy the temple,' one of the witnesses said, 'of God, and to build it in 3 days.'" Now, even though there were two witnesses who came forward, the problem is they contradicted each other. Mark, in his gospel, adds this little detail in chapter 14, verse 56. "For many bore false witness against Jesus, but their testimonies did not agree. Then some rose up and bore false witness against him, saying, 'We heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands.' But not even their testimonies agreed." Yeah, I think it went something like that. You know, I think I heard, you know, that kind of a thing. And they one guy said, "Well, I don't think it went like that. It went like this." And I don't know. No, it wasn't. Did he say he was going to build another, or was the same temple? I don't get what, you know, I think it was this. And so they're listening to this, and none of these guys can agree. Not only did Jesus not make this statement that he would build another temple in 3 days, but the law clearly states that any two witnesses' testimony must be consistent with each other from the start and finish and agree on every detail of that testimony. If they contradicted each other, the evidence was to be thrown out. But rather than throwing the evidence out and doing the right thing, notice how Caiaphas responds. The high priest in verse 62 arose and said to him, speaking to Jesus, "Do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you?" Now, a lawyer knows that an accused person must be given opportunity to cross-examine and confront his witnesses, the accusers. Does Caiaphas give that to Jesus? Say, "Well, why don't you talk to these guys that are bearing false witness against you and cross-examine them and ask them where they saw you and where they heard this and what were they doing when they heard this?" You know what? That's what should have been done. But that opportunity is never given to Jesus. Caiaphas simply continues the interrogation. We'll come back in a moment to see how Jesus responds, or rather, should I say, initially doesn't respond. But let's look at the next link in the chain of events here in verse 63. We read, and the high priest answered, but Jesus kept silent. And the high priest answered and said to him, "I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." And Jesus said to him, "It is as you said. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his clothes, saying, "You have spoken blasphemy. What further need do we have of witnesses? Look, now you have heard his blasphemy." Another error that I'd like to point out in this trial of Jesus was that the high priest renders his verdict first, and then he renders a decision that there's no further need of witnesses, in spite of the fact that the law of that day and this day demanded an opportunity for the defendant to call witnesses in his own defense. That's really bad. I mean, you talk about unfair. You talk about a travesty. But listen, if you think it's bad so far, it's going to get worse. How's that, you say? Well, listen to what verse 66 says. "What do you think?" Caiaphas is talking to the rest of the Sanhedrin and the people gathered there. "What do you guys think?" And they answered and said, "He's deserving of death." That was the ultimate, the sentencing and the miscarriage of justice. Because for that capital punishment decision to come down, the law required, first of all, that the Sanhedrin must vote one person at a time, and that the junior members had to vote first so that they would not be influenced by the older members. Number one. Number two, the high priest, being the chief justice, was to vote last, not first. Number three, after hearing the testimony in a capital case, members of the court were not allowed to render an immediate verdict or to set out an immediate verdict. In fact, in a capital case, they were required to hear the evidence out and then to adjourn to their homes for at least a day before the final verdict was to be passed. You see, this gives you some insight as to why knowledgeable judicial experts say that this trial represented the most unjust, irresponsible, unfounded verdict in the history of jurisprudence. Nothing like it has ever happened before or has happened after. It was the Son of God himself who had to experience this. That ought to tell you something. What's that, you ask? I'll tell you something about you and me who are followers of God. You see, If the son was treated unfairly, guess what? That says that you and I, or his disciples, will be too. If the Son of God was falsely accused, are we going to live exempt from false accusation? If life wasn't fair for Jesus, newsflash, it's not always going to be fair for you. Okay? Jesus warned us of this. In the world, you're going to have tribulation. Cheer up, I've overcome the world. He said, listen, if they hated me, guess what? They're going to hate you. The question is, how are you going to respond when life isn't fair? Because that's going to happen. How are you going to respond? How do you respond when others put you on trial for something that you are not guilty of? And here we are going to learn two things from Jesus as to how he responded so that we might properly respond. And the game changer is, listen, when life isn't fair, trust God to do what's right. That's the first thing we learn. You see, number one, what we learn from Jesus as he's going through this is the importance of trusting God. Trust God. Let's go back in verse 62 again and pick this up. And the high priest arose and said to him, do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you? And the high priest stood up and said to him, do you not answer? What is it that these men are testifying about? And Jesus kept silent. Now listen, the life of Jesus is on the line here. I mean, his life is on the line. He has a chance, as this high priest is questioning him, to defend himself, to speak his piece, to fire back, to take his shot, to say, you whitewashed sepulcher and miscarrier of justice, you bunch of kangaroo court morons. 3 a.m, here I am, this is illegal in every way, shape, and form. Who do you think you are? He could have done that. What did he do? What did he say? Well, initially we see he says nothing when it comes to the accusations. When it comes to the unfair treatment, he says nothing. Why didn't he say anything, you might ask? Well, I think there's some legal reasons why he didn't say anything. First of all, he had been arraigned. That is, he had been brought before the court without any charges, which was illegal. And he hadn't even been indicted yet. That means that there was no specific offense that he was brought in there for. So he pleaded the fifth. He had no legal obligation to testify against himself since no charges were officially filed. And he also knew something else, that no matter what he said, they weren't going to believe him. Remember, it was not the business of the council to solicit anyone's testimony. They were supposed to be acting in the capacity of an impartial group of judges to listen to the witnesses and then decide. So to Jesus, it was very obvious that they were determined to believe the worst about him and find him guilty regardless, you see. Every witness that was brought against him, there was good reason for that because they were all false. The law, of course, requiring two witnesses in the mouth of two or more witnesses, the Bible says, let every word be confirmed. They were unable to gather those, and yet they were continuing down this path. And so it was not his place to testify against himself. If Jesus had responded and given, you know, to the given false testimony, it would have given the entire illegal proceedings the appearance that this was a legitimate trial, which he knew it wasn't. And so Jesus did what most of the time we need to do.
That is really hard when we're being treated unfairly or accused falsely.
Be quiet. Just be quiet. Bugs people when you do that. But that's what he did. Listen, when your heart's right, when your motives are right, when your character and conduct before God is right and you are unjustly or unfairly accused and condemned, the best thing you can do is simply say nothing. It's true.
Do you do these things? Most of you get yes or no. If it's no, it's not. No, how could I? I mean, come on. I was there. Think about this. I could admit.
No, just let your yes be yes, your no be no. Because when you start to say, no, really, you could call. I was there. You already are acting guilty. You see, you're starting to defend yourself and testify. And simple no. If you're a man and a woman of integrity and character and it's true that you weren't there, you don't have to make up a bunch of stuff. You don't have to make out a bunch of proof. So let your yes be yes, your no be no. God will take care of it. I was falsely accused by some close friends and leaders in this church many years ago here. And unbeknownst to me, they had sent out a 10-page letter. Some of you probably have been around that long to receive that letter, accusing me of not preaching the gospel. Okay? And so when that letter went out, my first reaction was, I got to get up and tell the people this isn't true. I got to tell them. You know. And then I prayed and looked at it, I thought, wait a minute. Why do I need to do that? Here's the deal. If I'm not preaching the gospel, I don't belong in this pulpit. Okay? And so if I'm doing what they're accusing me of and not preaching the gospel, I leave that to the people to judge and for God to judge. And so you know what? I didn't get up before the people in this. I talked to the leaders a bit about the letter, and because it was a leadership issue, I talked, you know, to them about the leaders who I love to this day, But the bottom line is listen, I said, let the people decide. I'm not going to get in the pulpit and defend anything. Or you let the people decide. Lord, you know, man, my heart has always been to preach the gospel. And I want to see people come to know Jesus. And so if there's anything wrong with that, and then these people will leave if they believe these accusations. If it's true, they'll go. But I'm not going to get up here and defend. They know what I'm doing, and they're smart enough. They're smart enough to figure it out, and I'm just going to trust you with it. And I prayed for some of you. You know, some of you have been here that long, and that God would just give you wisdom, and that God's will would be accomplished. And certainly, if the whole church left, my feeling was then, and I'm not preaching the gospel, then I certainly don't belong in that pulpit. In the pulpit, so they better get out of here. But you see, you spend all the time defending it, and there was talk after. It was painful, very painful. So we talked. I had to come to the point in the office where I said, we need to quit talking about this. This is not profitable. I don't want to hear any more talk about it. I don't want to hear any more discussion about it. I don't want to hear any more, I can't believe it, or I'm hurt by it. I mean, we're hurt. We need to pray, and we need to press forward. You see, false accusations, if they're false, you can be confident you're in good company, right? If you're accused falsely, if your motives are misconstrued by somebody, to sit around and try and prove that you're not is many times a waste of energy. The reality is God knows and you know. So you can rest. God, take care of them. I love them. I don't see why they're not seeing this. And a lot of times, you know what I found out? You try and convince them. No, really, I'm not doing. Really, I'm not doing. And they are not going to believe you anyhow. Because they're obviously out there to, you know, to do some harm, or they've got some underlying, you know, scene going on, an idea, or they're bitter or bummed at you or something, and so you pray for them and love them. And I found this, and there's an old saying, and I've gone back to it many times. If you take care of your character, God will take care of your reputation. You take care of your character. When you know someone is out to get you, when you know someone is trying to find fault with you, know that they're always trying to look for the worst in you. They're not going to listen no matter. So the best thing, just say nothing. And then the greater reason that Jesus, the spiritual reason that Jesus didn't say anything, Peter later on looked back on this whole scene. He remembered it. How they were bringing the accusations, and he was a little ways back, it says here. He was still listening in. And later on in his letter that he writes, he remembers the scene and he says this in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 23. And while being reviled, speaking of Jesus, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but he kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. What a great example. When you're being falsely accused, other people are looking on. Man, just say, Lord, you know. And just love them in spite of it. And you know, it has a powerful testimony spiritually to those who are watching you navigate that false accusation, that unfair treatment. Jesus knew he was right, knew he was being obedient, he knew he had done no wrong. So he could trust the Father to take care of the situation. The only thing that we see Jesus say eventually is when the statement came, hey, you're accused of blasphemy, that you're saying that you're God. And Jesus, in verse 64, said, excuse me, it is as you said. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power, and coming on the clouds of heaven. I love that. Hey, you're guilty of blasphemy. Jesus is saying, yeah, I'm not guilty. Why? Because I am God. And here's what you're going to see, buddy. Let me paint your future. The day is coming, it's going to blow your mind, and you're going to be bummed at what you're doing right now. Because you're going to see me sitting on the right hand of power, coming on the clouds of heaven. Man, Jesus is saying, you don't bother me. Why? Because I got my eyes on heaven. So go ahead. Take your best shot. Here he is surrounded by his enemies. But guess what? His eye was on his Father in heaven, you see. Here he is, you know, everyone had abandoned him. The disciples had left him. But he knew heaven was on his side, even those on earth abandoned him. And that's all that mattered to him. It's a time to be silent, Ecclesiastes 3:7 says, and a time to speak. So there's another thing. The first thing we learn is trust God. The second thing we learn here is tell the truth. Jesus kept silent. The high priest answered and said to him, I put you, verse 63, under oath by the living God. This is humorous to me. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. I put you by oath. You need to swear by God, the living and true God. Oh, I can do that. Yeah, I'm him. I mean, it's a joke to me. The high priest putting Jesus under solemn oath to God to tell the truth. What he had unknowingly done was put Jesus in a situation where he was not only legally obligated to respond, but now he could really say what needed to be said. And after all, this is the real question, isn't it? Not only then, historically, in this case, but presently.
There was a time for silence, but now the time legally to speak comes. And Jesus says to him, hey, you have said it. In other words, this was a term or a figure of speech in that day. What he's saying is, hey, the way you put it is what it is, dude. And you've said plainly what I am. I am the Christ, as you stated. I am the Son of God. Accuse me all day long. Because that's not an accusation, that's a reality. Now don't miss this. At that point, everyone in that courtroom in that day of history, and everyone in this courtroom presently, you see, has to make a decision. Either Jesus Christ, as we see him here in our text, was guilty of blasphemy and innocent of being deity, or he was innocent of blasphemy and guilty of being deity. He was either a blasphemer and not God, or he was God and not a blasphemer. The truth is not one single witness could be found then, nor can be found today, even though they keep digging, don't they? Every once in a while, it'll pop up. We found the tomb where Jesus was buried, and we found that he was married, and still trying to pop it up, and then you look further into it, and the geologists study it a little bit more, and you find out it's no way it could be. It's crazy. But they're still looking, aren't they? Still trying to reduce Jesus to just simply being a man and not God. Still trying to point out that he was lying, that he wasn't who he claimed to be. And yet with all the investigation, with all the millions of dollars that have been spent looking and examining and checking, guess what they still have found? Powerful evidence. No wrongdoing. No wrong speaking. No wrong action. He is completely, totally innocent of doing anything wrong in any way, in any capacity, of ever saying anything wrong in any way, in any capacity. In fact, those who were in charge in that day, right down to Pilate, said, I find no fault in this man. You know why? Because he was God and is God. He's perfect. We are sinners, all men have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. But he is the sinless Son of God. He's God himself. He did always those things that please the Father. And even though he had been accused and declared guilty, he is yet to be proven, even down to this day. Many centuries and thousands of years later, to be proven guilty of anything. The only thing that Jesus was ever guilty of was being the Son of God, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, and the Savior of this world. And one day, the ones who put God on trial will be put on trial by God. Excuse me. Ultimately, that day, God wasn't on trial, just as it is in this day. You and I are on trial. Are we going to believe what Jesus said? Are we going to believe based on his existence and how he lived his life and the facts of his life? Are we going to believe that he was God and is God because he lived a perfect, sinless life and always did what he said and said what he did, and then he died on the cross, the sinless Son of God, to pay the price for sinners, and then he rose again on the third day to demonstrate that the Father had received his sacrifice for our sin? That's why there's no other way that you can get saved. God Himself, in His love for you, sent His Son to die, God Himself, for you on that cross. And then He rose again from the dead to change your life, demonstrating the acceptance of the Father of His sacrifice for your sin, for my sin. He bore those sins on that cross. That's why there's no other way to get saved. Because you kick dirt in the face of Jesus and say, oh, what a waste, the cross and the punishment. He rose to prove that He has the power to change you and pull you out of your dead life and give you abundant real life. You see, Jesus was proven innocent repeatedly. And the world, this justice travesty. They're still out there trying to do it, aren't they? Shows the hostility of the enemy. And it shows the power of Jesus to change lives, you see. His promises still being fulfilled. His power still working miracles in people's lives. Pulling them out of the pit of destruction and placing them on the road to heaven. Listen, if you're put on trial and life is unfair, just trust God and tell the truth and experience the victory that Jesus experienced and know you're in good company. Keep your eyes on heaven. Let's pray.